You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. We've been making cheese in Wisconsin since before we were even a state, which may be one reason why we win so many awards for it. It's what happens when a whole state dreams in cheese. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to Cutting the Curd on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Joe Salonia. On today's episode, we have Sean Hartwig, who's the specialty foods manager at Zingerman's Delicatessen in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Like many of Zingerman's deli staff members, Sean grew up in a family who loved to cook and showed love through food. Sean says food was the basis of his family get-togethers and holds a special place in his childhood memories. He started his career at Zingerman's Deli in the late 90s after working in Grand Rapids kitchen scene during high school. And after taking time away to study, travel, and manage the specialty store Morgan & York in Ann Arbor, Sean returned to Zingerman's in 2011, where he has been there ever since. While Sean's specialty is cheese, he loves to learn, serve, and cultivate a positive community around food. While not in a deli, you might find Sean cycling around Ann Arbor or leading a group of intrepid travelers on Zingerman's food tours. Sean, welcome to Cutting the Curd.
Joe, thank you so much. What an honor. First-time caller, long-time listener.
Right on. I love that. So it's so great to have you with us here. You're a wealth of knowledge, but I want to get right into it. But first, a basic thing. How would you describe Zingerman's to someone who is new to the business and does not know who or what Zingerman's Deli is in the cheese world?
Got it. So I'll give my 10-cent speech here. Zingerman's Deli was started and founded by Ari Weinzweig and Paul Saginaw, two gentlemen that went to University of Michigan in Ann Arbor and worked in kitchens and wanted to bring traditional deli food where they grew up, Paul outside of Detroit and Ari outside of Chicago, to Ann Arbor. At that time in the early 80s, the Midwest, much like many other cities in the area, were Germanic and Greek. Those were the food options you had. So traditional Jewish deli food was not present. And they had the opportunity to buy a beautiful two-story brick building in what is now the historic district of Carytown in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And they brought it to life. And so from March 15th, 1982, we'll have our 41st birthday here in a week or so. We have grown into an organization that has a dozen or so unique individual businesses that work together in collaboration to provide amazing food. The deli is the original business, and I'm lucky enough to manage the specialty food side of that, and specifically the cheese.
Right on. So the deli is still, would you say, is it fair to say that the deli is still like the heartbeat and the core of the foundation of the identity and vibe of visiting Zingerman's?
Yeah. Yeah, I would say that. I think the deli is a thriving enterprise. We have three different areas of the deli that the guests come through, whether they're first-time guests or our neighbors down the road. We have our specialty foods area when you walk in the front of the deli. And the heartbeat of the deli itself is sandwiches. That's what Ari and Paul wanted, was traditional Jewish sandwiches and food. And then we have a catering division.
And I guess that's kind of what I meant when I think of the deli. I'm thinking of those sandwiches and those foods that you mentioned in the beginning that Ari and Paul brought there. So that is the foundation through which all the businesses and themes throughout the Zingerman's network stands upon. Is it fair to say? And then at some point they launched a cheese program.
It is. The foundations, the tenets of Zingerman's is corned beef and the classic Reuben. And to that, as the business grew and became more successful with hard work and a little bit of luck in the mid-80s, We had the opportunity to expand the footprint of the deli and to incorporate more dry goods and sellable items that people could take home above and beyond sandwiches. And so that's where Ari and Paul developed their roles. Paul stayed with the kitchen and the sandwich side of things, and Ari was able to expand into learning about cheeses, meats, olive oils, et cetera.
Right on. And I love all that. And then, so now, how many cheeses does Zingerman's carry at any given time?
I love that question. I went and counted just to get ready for a question like that. Right now, currently, we have 142 cheeses. We could have anywhere from 125 to 170, depending on the time of year and the mix.
So cheeses tend to add up fast, and you're counting like cheese spreads, you're counting mozzarella, burrata, all the categories. That's under perishables, I'm going to guess, right? All the perishable, highly perishable, some has a longer shelf life, shorter shelf life, but at any given time, 125 to 170 is your range. And does that number, does the number go up higher during the winter holiday season, or does it tend to be a different time of year?
That's a good question. So we're at a university town with the University of Michigan right around the corner here in Ann Arbor. So we have big spikes around graduation, around football season, the holidays, whether they be Jewish or Christian, Thanksgiving to anyone who works in retail, from Thanksgiving to Christmas. It's like 3 months worth of sales. And so our volume tends to expand during those times and then contract in the slower months, January and February.
So as popular as Zingerman's is, and with all those beautiful things happening that help drive your business throughout the year, is it tempting to just keep adding more, but you practice some restraint, and is there a strategy behind that? Because I'm going to guess if you could, in theory, carry more, you could carry less. How do you find the right amount? I think this is probably everybody's gut check question. You can't just carry everything you love all the time, or maybe you're getting requests and you could add more, or having the right balance, I guess, is everything.
Yeah. It's wonderful to think that we could carry everything. Wouldn't it be amazing? So I'm constricted in some ways physically with the capacity of the counter. I think it's important for everyone out there to understand that Zingerman's Deli is still a cut-to-order cheese shop. So we bring in whole wheels outside of spreads and grab-and-go items, and we cut to order. So I only have so much counter space that's non-refrigerated and so much that's refrigerated. And so a lot of my holding capacity for cheeses is based around how many square feet we have and then how fast we want to turn those cheeses. So whether it be a soft cheese, I'd love to have them here for less than 30 days. We don't do any affinage. It's like the highest end hospice for dairy you can find. We want to take the intentions of the cheesemakers and dairy men and women, and we want to convey that to the guests and get out of the way of that interaction in some ways. And so aged cheeses tend to be on our counter or in our coolers for no more than 60 days. So we have high turns, not a lot of holding capacity, and that really dictates the volume, the overall volume and number of cheeses I can sell.
And do you aim for whole wheels when possible, within reason? I remember in 2014... 15, right around there, you were the first one to really share time with me and show me how to cut my first wheel of Emmentaler, AOP, which was so awesome of you. And I'm guessing over the years, you've taught many cheesemongers how to crack their first Parm wheel or wire a big wheel of Comté, Gruyère, Emmentaler, other big wheels. So is that a pretty common occurrence? And how many mongers do you think you've taught over the years? It must be a lot.
Yeah. I'll go back to your first question, which is we try to bring in whole wheels exclusively. And that's just because the quality is never going to be better than when you first open that wheel. And that's really important for mongers, whether they be new to the cheese scene or mongers that have been around forever. That first taste of a freshly cracked wheel is inspiring. And I think that's what conveys the value of these these products that aren't cheap in our world. I am one of a long line of amazing cheese buyers at the deli. I mean, if you go all the way back, you have people like Deborah Dickerson. You have David Lockwood, Carlos Souffrant. We have people that have really set the stage for some, Matt Morgan, set the stage for some amazing cheese care and passed on a torch that I carry with pride to continue a cut-to-order cheese program.
Yeah, the Zingerman's counter has been kind of a like Ivy League of cheese school for folks that are interested in the cheese business to work and learn and then go on to great things. And I have to wonder why is this so? And one of the things that I find as I get to meet, I know Deborah really well. I've met Carlos and I know Carlos a little bit. And one thing that seems to be within them is this servant leadership. And of course, Ari, obviously, when you meet them, you feel servant leadership is a big tenet in philosophy of Zingerman. So can you explain how, if that's one of the cornerstones and how you implement this philosophy into day-to-day business?
I'm happy to speak to servant leadership, but I also want to go back. Just we really have a unique situation here in Ann Arbor where no one that comes and works in with our cheeses and with our specialty foods department studied cheese, dairy science, et cetera. I mean, people come from all different backgrounds, some from the university side, some from being a townie. But I think everyone out there that works with cheese understands that the value of learning and growing and sharing something so authentic is being able to sell and taste cheese. It's a really, I think, humble way and meaningful way to work. As far as servant leadership goes, we've done a lot of consulting over the years to be better, whether it be from a service side or a financial side or a food side. And one of the ways in which Ari and Paul gave us a lot of gifts was being willing to consult and learn from other people. One of those being Robert Greenleaf, who many people know, who developed through essays in the 70s, this idea of servant leadership towards peers and individuals, but also in following essays, servant leadership for organizations and businesses. And the idea is we are at our best and we are doing our best work and most elevated work when we are caring for each other and working for each other towards a greater unified goal.
I love that. I love that. Yeah. We need more of that in this world. So does this help you attract more cheese team members in general, you think?
That's a good question. I don't think people want to understand what is Zingerman's. I want to work for Zingerman's. And I don't know, obviously when you come from the outside and you're getting a job, you'll say anything to get a job. But people that really want to learn about our culture and our values and how we work together tend to come away doing better things, going better places in their lives and utilizing a lot of the concepts we use professionally in their personal lives. And that's a testament to the work.
So maybe it helps them stick around longer and they feel like they're actually, I mean, the vibe I get with the people that worked at Zingerman's is they felt like it like enriched their lives. Like they grew as people along with learning about cheese. And I just think to myself, how wonderful is it to have a job like that? That's really, I think, all of our goals is to work and learn, enjoy, grow, and then on top of it, maybe have, you know, get this servant leadership mindset kind of in your bones a little bit. Do you think does that increase when folks come on board? They actually discover, oh, hey, this place is special. It's not just
I wish I could capture the essence of what makes people want to stay with us. We're really lucky. We have low turnover in our world. We have really amazing retention. And for a retail environment in a university town, that's unheard of. And so what I found as I witness these cohorts of staff come through is they form really meaningful bonds inside and outside of work. It's not necessary. We don't all have to be friends. We just have to work for the same goals professionally. But many times these groups form these bonds that last for years and years, if not a lifetime. It's amazing to witness.
Wow. That's really unique. I'm sure everybody would love to know the secret sauce that, of how to have low turnover at a job. But it's probably something simple, but like the things you've outlined, but easier said than done. You need everybody on board. And that's what you guys seem to have. Now the trend lately, I mean, if you talk to any store, just because of the pandemic and maybe other conditions, it's that the trend is that there's less retention. It's becoming less and less. It seems there's more movement, or every now and then there'll just be, sometimes notice in the industry, there's like a shedding and then lots of people are moving around at once. But that seems to be happening in closer successions. Do you feel that at the counter that there is less, they stay a little less since the pandemic, or do you feel like it's almost the same, or are they staying longer since the pandemic?
Well, we don't have enough information post-pandemic. We have a almost 2 years under our belt to really see some data. But what I have found is businesses, even businesses like Zingerman's, that work with a lot of empathy and care in their actions, had a lot of turnover before the pandemic. Working conditions weren't great. Pay wasn't exceptional. Benefits didn't allow people to thrive. Employees to thrive. And so I think coming out of the pandemic, for the deli itself, our hours changed, our systems changed, the tools we use have changed. And I think that group of events that all happened and coalesced around the pandemic has made for a really beneficial work environment.
Well, that you mentioned some things there. So could you give our listeners an example of one or two examples of how either systems or hours have changed? Yeah. And when you say hours, you mean working hours or store hours or both?
Both. So okay. I manage the deli specialty foods. That's about 20 full-time staff. We don't have many part-time staff in our group. So we're really lucky in that regard. Before the pandemic, the deli was open from 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. So you're in essence, two shift work. So for a scheduler or a hiring manager, you're contending with that amount of labor and those inputs. And after the pandemic, we now open the deli at 11 a.m. and close at 7 p.m. And so it's changed what was five-day-a-week work for our staff pre-pandemic to four longer days and 3 days off. And it's really beneficial to home life.
Let me hear that again. So before the pandemic, hours were what time to what time?
7 a.m. to 10 p.m. Wow. And staff would work an average of 5 days a week. And so you might work an opening shift or you might work a closing shift, 2 to 10 or 6:30 to 2:30. And now people come in at 10 and they leave just after 7. And it's just a different type of work.
Yeah, that's a big shift right there you mentioned.
Yeah, it's huge.
I mean, if I was working there, I probably would have been pleased to hear the change. That's actually what you could imagine, a less intense schedule to manage. And then how about system-wise? What kind of changes are we talking about?
So the deli, we are slow adopters of technology, to say the least. We still take orders over the phone with pen and paper. And so the pandemic forced our hand. We had to get online and get into e-commerce very quickly. All our businesses outside of mail order, who's been doing it amazingly for years, did the same thing. And then we used different platforms and we learned from each other. And so what we did is we had one software system for e-commerce that the sandwich line used for restaurant items. And our catering team used a second one. And specialty foods, we went with Square. And so we had three different e-commerce platforms that didn't speak to the in-house POS, if you can believe that. It made it challenging, but we learned a lot from that process. So we had both online and in-house sales. The belated glimpse of the obvious is it's much easier to process an online order both from a staffing standpoint and an efficiency standpoint. I mean, people are buying food from you when you're sleeping, and you can fill that order in a timely fashion, much different, in a different way than if a guest is walking through your business and ordering from your staff.
It's quite a different pathway to getting the product in their hand, isn't it? It's completely a whole different equation. So getting back to employees, I'm going to guess you had any new hires in the last, I don't know, few months? And what do you tell those people? Or in the last year, what do you tell someone starting who's their first day? What do you say to someone?
So as far as our hiring, we have not hired since last year, knock on wood.
You're not kidding.
We've been really lucky, really lucky. And as far as the first day goes, it's like, I mean, anyone who's worked on a cheese counter or in a food shop, it's potentially like drinking from a fire hose. And the deli is no different. We try to do our darndest to prepare people for what's important. They do a lot of tasting. They do a lot of analysis. We talk about how to evaluate foods professionally versus personally. And we also lower the bar. You walk through, Joe, you walk into the deli and you see someone, it's their first day. You assume they know everything about those 142 cheeses, how to use them and what beverages go well with them. And the truth is, we want our staff to be really honest, especially in their first months, if not year, to be really truthful with our guest and to not BS them and say, hey, I have no idea, but I'm really looking forward to finding out with you and sharing that knowledge and that journey. And that's growth.
That's a great line. I love the authenticity of that. So the rule of engagement for your guests and customers who visit your shop, it can vary from monger to monger, but you're encouraging them to be brutally honest and almost really just be natural. So you're setting them up for being comfortable in themselves. So you're creating an environment that sounds kind of warm and fuzzy, I'm gonna imagine. And
many people have said that about Zingerman's warm. So
yeah,
the simplest recipes tend to be the easiest to follow, like a service recipe or a system. And so our definition of giving great service, whether it be to the food or to each other, is very simple. You find out what the guest wants, you get it for them, and you go the extra mile. And so in this case, if you're day one employee, you can easily find out what a guest wants. Clearly, you have no idea how to get it for them, but you can engage and feel comfortable in that process and then bring one of our fellow staff members in to help and to teach and to coach.
The team is there for you, and you have a built like family-like confident team with very little turnover. So yeah, the knowledge is in the room, I'm guessing, at any given day. They're not going to be lost looking around. Isn't Zingerman's very famous for sampling almost like anything in the store? Is that, did I hear that right? I mean, when I was there, Ray were ready to open up any bottle that might not even have been opened at that moment for me to taste something, like as far as the condiments or vinegars. Is that something that you still do post-pandemic, or how do you handle that?
We do. Obviously, with online commerce, there's less in-store sampling in that respect. But there's nothing in the deli that people need to survive, whether it be a piece of cheese or a Reuben or a bottle of olive oil. Those are not the essential components of a basket of goods when you go to the grocery store. Well, they are for me, but not for many people. I'm lucky in that respect. So when people walk through our door, it's really important that they feel comfortable and we lower the bar to what is specialty foods now, which really are just traditional foods, fermented foods in many ways, ways to keep protein and fat from going rancid. And we convey that through sampling. That can be the guest asking us for a sample, or if we're on our game and we're doing our best, it's like, hey, I just tasted this amazing cheese, you should taste it too. And that sets the tone for the experience that people have with us, where it lowers the threshold of anxiety potentially that a guest could come in with, feeling like they don't understand what we do, but they want to be a part of it. And usually, whether it leads to a sale or not, it will lead to goodwill and word of mouth, which is how we get a lot of our clients back and guests back.
So there's not necessarily upselling per se in the conventional sense, but they're just like, you're just sharing, like if someone's asking for a sample of something, it's, you might go ahead and pass it to a couple more people, or if a cheesemonger's tasting something, you might, without being prompted, go ahead and just hand it to a guest in the store. Is it kind of the move? And is it intimidating to people? Do you find that people are many gourmands walking in, or you have all levels? I'm going to guess you have like someone like my Uncle Louis in the shop, who's basically life revolves around sharp provolone, and you might, you know, like everything.
And that's all right.
You know, and that's fine. No, totally, yeah. I mean, we need Uncle Louis, and sometimes Uncle Louis is bringing his the cousin, is his son or daughter, and they're the ones into the fancy tuna or the fancy olive oil, right?
We get them all, and so we used to. Post-pandemic, so we have within specialty foods three areas. We have the perishables counter, that cut-to-order meat and cheese counter. We have an area where we sell our bread and packaged goods that are made by one of our sister businesses, our bakehouse, that get delivered to the deli four times a day. And then we have that essential pantry and larder area we call dry goods. And so we train our staff in all those areas over time. And that allows them to take their guest from one counter to the other without pointing or telling someone else to help out and break that relationship that you form with the guest and to fill up any basket of goods that people want. So upselling really comes from, A, the staff being really enthusiastic about food and knowing how to use our products so that they can convey a recipe or a process or something that would go amazing with it. But also finding out where the customer's at. Do they want to spend an hour with us, or are they coming from the hospital down the road and they need to grab something and get out?
Right, reading the customer and understanding what they're looking for. I want to dive more into those other departments besides the cheese counter at the deli. But first, I just want to take a break for our sponsor, and we'll be right back. And then I want to dive into more of those topics.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. There's a reason when you think of Wisconsin, you think cheese. Cheese is a huge part of Wisconsin's history and future. In Wisconsin, the state of cheese, the tradition of cheesemaking excellence began 180 years ago, before Wisconsin was recognized as a state. Immigrants traveled to settle in this lush green hills of Wisconsin, bringing their cheesemaking traditions with them. These storied skills combined with the freshest milk available created a cheesemaking culture that is uniquely Wisconsin. Wisconsin's 1,200 cheesemakers, many of whom are third and fourth generation, continue to pass on old world traditions while adopting modern innovations in cheesemaking craftsmanship. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Welcome back, everyone. We're here chatting with Sean Hartwick from Zingerman's Deli on Cutting the Curd on the Heritage Radio Network. Sean, we were talking about some of the fancier items, the grocery and the items in the other categories. Maybe we're getting into tinned fish. We're alluding to some of those things and jams and cheese accompaniments. And before we actually get into my questions with you, I wanted to talk pricing strategy or just price in general, because sometimes those items which can seem common in a store like a Zingerman's will give someone who's never been to a fancy or a higher end specialty store, they're discovering what the price of goods can cost to deliver such an amazing product. But to give it context, I sometimes do my own price matching at the big grocery store. We're talking, I could be at the Target. I happen to live almost next to a Target store here in New Jersey. And I found some fun stats on some familiar snacks. And I broke them out in a price per pound. Just to kind of give context. Now, this isn't airport or movie theater prices. These are the grocery aisle at the checkout counter at a common grocery store. Okay, I'm going to throw a few at you. I just want to hear what you think. So, pirate booty, my favorite cheesy snack, by the way. I love pirate booty. A 4 ounce bag, if you extend the cost, is $28.99. Amazing. Per pound. 4 ounce bag, $28.99 per pound. Thank you for clarifying. Yes, if you break it out and you extend it per pound. Tic Tacs. Tic Tacs. $27.99 per pound. By the way, Tic Tacs were invented in 1969. And they're sold in 100 countries. This is not a paid advertisement for Tic Tacs, by the way. A pack of gum. You know, I like drinking. I like eating the Orbit. Orbit, $26 a pound. If you're buying one pack at a time, it comes out to $26 a pound. Kit Kats, my favorite chocolate candy at the checkout counter, $21.99 per pound. And a friendly reminder, your iPhone or Google phone is probably about $1,100. So.
By weight.
By weight. Per pound. Per unit. That's the each. So, you know, I often find it funny how some folks will be like, what? How much is that? Like when they find out the price of a cheese. But meanwhile, they don't think twice about a pack of gum, pirate booty, Tic Tacs, Kit Kats. So it's just like a perception or an expectation. Do you find any like barriers to price acceptance in the store much, or is it because the magic of Zingerman's kind of gets people in a different headspace? How does it work for you?
No, I think anyone in their right mind that walks in and sees a $600 bottle of balsamic vinegar that's a couple ounces should have some reaction. That may be awe, it may be horror, it may be amazement, it may be I want three, all of which are okay. Our job is to, you know, we buy our products across the board. Ari really set up a paradigm for us where we buy our food products on a basis of traditionally made and full flavored. Price isn't one of those considerations. And so when you're buying products and you're only criteria is that it's traditionally made and full flavored, then the price is a byproduct of that. And you can convey the cost of something to a guest. They may not want to consume it or to buy it. They may not see the value in it, but we can as salespeople and employees convey the value of that. Now that said, it gets to be a little bit like an echo chamber. We live in shop and eat in the deli. And it's not a cheap place to be. And I think having that perspective of going out and visiting other shops, talking to other mongers, price comparisons are really valuable exercises for all retailers.
So we have a sense of market, so to speak, and in geographical areas can impact that and the path that a cheese can take from wherever its place of origin to your counter. How do you administer cheese price? Do you do by the pound, or you do in half pound or quarter pound? Have you ever done or changed that format? I'm always fascinated how in our industry we're charging by the pound, and you know, like the way we buy whole chicken or ground meat, but we have to divide versus multiply, and I hate division, so I'd rather rather it be a different way. But it seems like we're stuck at most counters by putting a full by the pound price. So how do you guys do it?
We've oscillated between strictly whole pound and each cost on our signage to showcasing both the half pound and the whole pound pricing, or the half and each. And the reason we did that initially was to test it to see if it had an effect. On average, our cheese sales were anywhere from a third, you know, to 4/10 of a pound. And so showing someone the price per pound in a high energy retailing environment like Zingerman's Deli may lead to frustration on their part. And so we do our darndest not to obfuscate the cost of things. You know, the name, the primary message, and the price are all very big on our signs for a reason. We don't want to feel like we're pulling something over on people. And that's part of the reason we provide samples.
I also heard from more than one shop that when they did the quarter pound price to kind of make the price look less, that everybody was fine, but they just ordered a quarter pound all day long. I'll take a quarter pound of that. I'll take a quarter pound of that. I'll take a quarter pound of that all day long.
Oh,
they never sold more than a quarter of a pound. So yeah, that ruined a chance for just cutting about, you know, hey, how does this piece look? Big enough for it? Yeah, I'll take that. And then it weighs what it weighs, right?
Yeah, it's interesting. Those modifiers you can play around with online a little easier, you know, with drop-down menus and giving optionality to people who are shopping online. But you also then influence the choices by providing those options. So I think it's fun to experiment.
Right on. Experimentation is good, but you're back to the pound, which I totally get. And I guess it's where we're comfortable. It's our frame of reference. Just changing topics here. Speaking of some news that I read this week about the word milk being defended by the U.S. Dairy Farmers and National Milk Producers Federation introducing a national bill, the Dairy Pride Act it'll be this year, 2023. Do you get requests for many non-dairy cheeses, or do you carry any or plan to carry any?
It's a controversial topic, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, this word milk.
There's a lot wrapped up in it.
Yeah, by the way, for the listeners who maybe need to hear a little bit more, I just stated a headline, but the word milk is under, you know, usage attack, so to speak, meaning the dairy farmers only want to have use of the word milk, and the nut milk whole branch, whether or milk substitute as we know it, wants to continue to use the word. So the soy milk, the almond milk, the cashew milk, and so on, it's they want to have control, or they want to force them to not use the word milk. It's just incredible. Yeah. Like, this is there's such a word that you think is so basic. But
I found words are really powerful.
Words, I mean, names. Yeah.
How we use them. I think we have guests. Well, I know we have guests that come in all the time looking for substitutes and derivations. And it's not something we do. And it's not something we're ashamed to not carry. It just doesn't fit into our model of business right now. I mean, we really stand by the traditionally made full flavored aspects of selling fermented dairy products. And milk has a very specific definition to us and how we use that. And it's not to ostracize people's ideas or needs or food allergies or anything like that, food choices. It's just, this is what we do and this is why we do it. And here's how we define it. And then it allows people to make choices and to find those things. We're happy to also point out where those things are available in the marketplace. Because someday down the road, there will be a tradition of these type of fermented products. And we'll have to, as a group, create definitions and terms that we can all stand by. And I can imagine a time that Zingerman's may carry those products. But currently it's so new and nebulous and undefined that as a consumer, I'm enjoying watching things transpire, although I hope we all in the industry really take heed and think about how we use the term milk.
It seems like they're trying to say that, hey, you're confusing people by calling this almond milk. I'm not confused. I know exactly what it is. It's not from a cow and it's almond milk. I don't Correct. Find it confusing at all. What is confusing for more people is the Greer ruling, which got doubled down on the appeal for the use of the word. So it just makes, I hopefully it gives us at folks who work at good cheese counters, a chance to, you know, educate their guest and have them rediscover what Legriere AOP is versus the generic word now will be Gruyere for just anything that anybody wants to call the cheese that reminds them of the cheese Gruyere. It's sad that Gruyere or the Legvier AOP don't have this, have the pull to make this word stick in other markets, including the USA. It almost reminds me of when Prince lost the right to call himself Prince, and he had to turn himself into a symbol, you know, or something like that. We get a reaction as cheese people, right? So your hot take on that, are you concerned?
It's a byproduct of the U.S. and North America not having a clear taxonomy for how we talk about the derivation of our foods and our food ways. So to not be able to say, I remember back at ACS in Montreal when Health Canada was trying to help come up with a taxonomy and a way to talk about place and derivation of some of their amazing, unique products. And I thought the U.S. is going to be just around the bend. And that's been, 12 years or something since then? So I think it's an unfortunate byproduct of not realizing how many amazing foods we have that are our own and how to create uniqueness around them and to not see it as competition. But the European system for controlling origin and denomination is something to be modeled, not something to be, you know, deconstructed.
Unfortunately, from what I could extrapolate from it, my takeaways is that it's just so politically loaded. There's so much behind it. I mean, it goes back to the time where we might have boycotted cigarettes from France or something, or vice versa. And so it's just, there's so much behind it and a lot of lobbying. But getting back into this other part of the shop that is Zingerman's, since the pandemic, did you see a boon in the rediscovery or the expansion of eating more cured meats, more cheese boards per se that folks are now a little more comfortable with, chocolate bars, preserved fish, you know, these categories they were definitely booming during the height of the pandemic. Have some of that stuck?
You know, that's interesting, right? How do eating habits maintain? So people were eating at home. They were preparing food. They were reading food journals and the New York Times food column to see what people were making and how they were making it, and then going out to shop. And we were the benefactor of those shopping excursions and learning about tin fish and seafood, learning about different ways of preparing pulses and utilizing products. And so that is still continuing, although we're seeing here in Ann Arbor an uptick in people going back to restaurants. And so there's a bit of a slowdown, but at the same time, once you have an amazing, tinned mackerel from Portugal, it's hard to go back. And then on top of that, you get it at a sale price right now at Zingerman's mail order, and it's a good value.
That stuff is so healthy too. It's the omegas on that are just such healthy foods for you to eat. So would you say that this category helps supplement the cheese program? Like, is it critical that like you need to be thinking about selling this category if you have a cheese shop, just to have a shelf stable item with a good margin on it, takes up a small amount of space, a lot of value and a small square footage on the counter. Versus crackers, say, you know, or potato chips. You know, if you have like 3x3 feet of chocolate, you could have like $10,000 worth of chocolate and tin fish in like a 3x3 foot cube. I'm serious. That's right. Can't have that with potato chips or crackers, right? So if you have a small shop and you don't have tin fish or chocolate and you want to keep selling cheese at a good margin and be competitive, is this part of the strategy, or are you just putting stuff you love in your store and it's just that simple?
Well, our buyers, so we're a little unique in that respect. The buyers that buy in certain categories, you see a lot of an expression of their own likes and dislikes and the things they bring in. So over time, as we have new buyers, the product mix changes slightly. And that keeps it fun. As far as tin fish and seafood, that was an old coworker and manager, Bill Marshall, who really fell in love with tin fish and did a big push on it. Tin fish and seafood, much like wine, you could have the same tin sardine over three different vintages, and it's remarkably different. You know, it's an annual crop. The flavors are different. The textures are different every year. And so, yeah, I don't think you need to have those products with cheese or to supplement sales or margin. I think it for us, having traditionally made foods that are full flavored, all of our products go through that filter, and it's reflected in our selections. You know, we can't have everything. And things, amazing cheeses that you find elsewhere, you won't find at Zingerman's because you can find them elsewhere. And that's really important to acknowledge. We're either going to provide a service to the guest that walks through the door, or we're going to provide a unique product they can't get elsewhere.
I love that. And is there a trend that you're predicting to happen or that you miss? Like this was to me a pandemic trend, but do you see one happening, or is there one you missed from the first time you stepped foot in Zingerman's 15, 20 years ago? Or actually it's more than 20 years ago.
With a nice break in between.
Nice break in between. Yeah. But you know, what's in your crystal ball, or what do you miss that you might be able to bring back and relaunch? Is there anything that comes to mind?
Well, the thing that kept us back then, the thing that was so unique was we really had a foothold on importing unique products that you couldn't find elsewhere, whether it be olive oil or vinegar, not so much cheeses and meats per se. We used really good relationships with the distribution chain for that. But those were the things that were eye-opening to me, coming out of kitchens and making inexpensive food look acceptable on a plate, was to take these amazing, unique, individual ingredients that you can't find elsewhere and to combine them into something really exceptional. And that for me was amazing. The other things back then that were so unique were the deli was in a smaller footprint. We've done a big expansion. And whether it's time or a little bit of haze, the smells and the energy in the space before was different. Not better or worse, just unique to that moment. And so now the bacon comes out of the oven in a different spot. And so in the morning, it smells different. The sounds are different. The acoustics, wow. All those same things.
Those are some cool things to kind of think about. It's not just so simple, either way you're describing it, you're kind of painting a picture. So is there a new product or is there a feature coming up? I read you're part of Zingerman's tours. So is that something that's new, or you're part of that's a new thing for you, or anything you want to mention that's coming up that's exciting?
As far as new products, I have a domestic cheese buyer, Scott Evans, and he's bringing in a lot of fun cheeses from the U.S. And that's been fantastic for me to learn as well. I tend to stick to the imported cheeses. So keep an eye out on our website for all the fun things he's finding and working with our domestic producers. And food tours. So Zingerman's food tours came out of one of our specialty foods managers was married to a woman from Spain. And we were already traveling and importing foods. And so Ari had the idea of why not allow people to come with us as we visit producers. And the first food tour was in Spain. And so they visited cheese producers and ham producers and olive oil producers, et cetera. And they put together the tour on their own. I'm sure there was an insurance nightmare to do that. But now, in this day and age, our food tours business has evolved. And we have a owner-operator. So the way Ari and Paul grew, instead of franchising the deli, they created a parent company. And they own half of each business that comes out of Zingerman's organization. with an operator owner or multiple operator owners that get to share in the upsides and downsides of running a business. And Christy, the amazing Christy, runs our food tours company right now. She's actually in Morocco leading a food tour currently. And you can check those out at zinghamasfoodtours.com. But they these tours bring people all over, primarily Europe, but they connect a lot of our food producers, and Christy really is into wine, and so we do a lot with wine and create experiences that people wouldn't normally get to do on a traditional vacation.
What's your role in that?
So there are multiple tour partners. Christy can't go on all of them, and so there are select staff around our businesses that get to help lead these tours. And so I've been fortunate enough to lead some to Sicily, and I look forward to leading more.
These places have just drenched in history. I'm so happy to hear that that the U.S. cheeses are still a fabric of the counter. And will there be tours for anything U.S. related in that sense, where you can visit a bunch of dairies, or more focused on Europe for now, I guess?
It's a great question. No. Domestic tours, we don't do a lot of, but I think that there's a big area of opportunity there, whether it's a 3-day or 4-day tour. If you think about people our age traveling, we don't have 9 days, 12 days to go over to Europe and totally soak it in. It'd be great if we could, but that's not the reality. So how do people like us get to go on a really cool tour, fly into some, you know, to the Southeast and stay somewhere amazing and get to work with a handful of producers in a region and get back home in a reasonable amount of time? I think there's a big area of opportunity there.
I love the idea of it. I mean, I just want to come to Michigan and visit. I mean, to me, it's one of the most beautiful states. It's a totally immersive four-season state between all the hilly regions and the lakes. What's your favorite seasonal activity, non-work, and why? I wanted to ask you this earlier, but I'll ask it now.
Oh, man. Yeah, I'm a Michigander. I was born and raised here. And I love the fall and the wintertime. And I love being outside. We're inside, you know, so many hours of our lives when we do this type of work. And I love just to get out, whether it be on a bike or in the woods, or hanging out with dogs or whatever it may be, just to be in nature. And we're lucky enough to have a lot of that in Michigan, whether it be in the Upper Peninsula or the Lower.
Yeah, it's God's country up in the Upper Peninsula. I mean, the whole place. I mean, each lake is so different looking, different colors, different surroundings. Some are in wooded areas. Some are open, like ocean beaches. I was just blown away by that when I visited Michigan years ago, and I'm well overdue for a visit. And what do you normally have in your backpack when you're cycling? What's your favorite snack? Is it something like a Kit Kat? Like, if you're like me, do you have a little something that's a little low brown and something a little fancy, or is it always going to be something right off the counters at Zingerman's?
I'm a food enthusiast, not a snob. So lowbrow to me is fantastic. No, I tend to roll with whatever is in the fridge. It might be some Gorp, or it might be a...
Wait, Gorp? What is that? Gorp, that's the bicycle.
It's raisins and nuts and M&Ms. You know, we grew up calling it Gorp. Just whatever is available in the fridge. I love pears. I love fruit. Just get out and go. A hunk of cheese goes a long way to making people happy.
You could pack a hunk of cheese and go biking with some Gorp. I mean, that's what we all need to be doing. And Sean, I just want to say thank you for being on the show. It's so great to talk this way with you. I don't see you enough or talk to you enough. So thank you. And hopefully we help some cheesemongers out there feed all our cheesy fans' souls. And we got some new thoughts out into the airwaves.
Yeah, it's a pleasure of mine. I really appreciate the opportunity. And anyone who wants to connect with me, please do. We'd love to have you come spend a day at the deli and check out the counter with us.
So come back anytime, Sean. And everyone listening, you could follow Sean and his fine work at Zingerman's Deli on Instagram at Zingerman's Deli. Plus, you can follow us on Instagram at Cutting the Curd, and you can follow me at Sting Chef. Please listen and subscribe to Cutting the Curd via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Also, some friendly reminders. The ACS scholarships are open for application, so please visit cheesesociety.org/scholarship if you're interested in applying for scholarships to this year's conference. And the DZTA and DZRA application season is beginning now. Please visit DZTE.org for the application packets. And lastly, the 2023 applications are now open for the Ann Saxelby Legacy Fund for a fully funded month-long summer 2023 apprenticeship on the farm. To learn more, go to www.annsaxelbylegacyfund.org before March 15th. To submit your application. Thanks again, everyone. And if you love someone, send them cheese.
Cutting the Curd is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.